Dr. Grebner's education includes a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, master's from the University of Oklahoma, and a PhD in history from the University of Chicago. During the past 15 years, he has taught at Iowa State University, Stanford, and at present he is at the University of Illinois. He has further served as Fulbright Lecturer at Queensland University in Australia, Commonwealth Fund Lecturer at the University of London, and has delivered the Fleming Lectures at Louisiana State University, among many other engagements. Of the 8 books that he has either written or edited, his latest is Ideas in Diplomacy, published recently by Oxford University Press in 1964. Dr. Grebner's chief interest is American foreign policy. His course in American diplomacy has in the past been broadcast directly from the classroom at the University of Illinois. Should remind you also at this time that Dr. Grebner will meet students from 3:30 and 4:30 informally for discussion at the student lounge, at which time he says he will also entertain questions about Vietnam. But his topic this morning is obligation versus interest in American foreign policy. Dr. Grebner.
Professor von der Lage, students, faculty, and friends of Concordia Senior College. As a member of the Missouri Senate, I cannot appear on this platform except under the feeling of emotion, because I think all of us are extremely proud of the administration, the faculty, the students, as well as the campus of this college. On such a tremendous occasion as this, I hope only that I can live up to its possibilities. Indeed, I hope I do somewhat better today than that politician of the 1960 campaign who had in his audience two men rather hard of hearing seated in the front row. Midway through a speech, the one yelled to the other that was fortunate enough to have a hearing aid, "What's he talking about?" The other yelled back, "He don't say." But as I look at this excellent audience, Professor von der Lage, I assure you that I feel far better than that one renowned speaker who, after a great deal of publicity, came to the lecture hall and found only one man person, a man seated in the back row. But he was a speaker of great experience. He said, "Well, good sir, since you've come to hear me, I'm going to give you my entire speech," the man yelled back. He said, "Well, hurry up and finish it. I'm the janitor and I want to go home." I think on an occasion such as this, one is tempted to say everything that he knows. I can't quite achieve that in 1 hour's time, but I'll do my best. And I think if there's any theme under which I might approach that task, it is the one that I have selected for today's address, namely that of obligation versus interest in American foreign policy. Certainly more than any nation in history, the United States carries an obligation towards the oppressed of mankind. To be sure, it is a burden that has never been recognized or shared by all Americans. Indeed, through most of this country's history, the preponderance of political influence has decreed that the United States limit its obligations abroad to serving its own requirements. But there have always been Americans, often distinguished and highly placed, who have demanded in times of revolution and crisis that the United States dare pursue no less than the cause of humanity. This sense of obligation has stimulated every important foreign policy debate within this nation since the presidency of George Washington. It explains the magnitude of the disagreements which have characterized the American outlook on world affairs. Unlike spokesmen of other nations, American leaders have seldom confined their arguments to varying interpretations of the national interest. Rather, the debates they have launched have ranged over two fundamental and totally divergent concepts of acceptable national behavior. Those who have denied that the United States carries any special obligation for the people of other nations have accepted what might be termed the analytical approach to foreign affairs. This concept suggests that a foreign policy serves a nation. It discovers the ends of prudent action in a country's historic traditions, its geographical location, its security requirements, the economic, social, and political welfare of its citizens. These taken together create the national interests which a foreign policy seeks to defend. But remember that for nations that are not omnipotent, it is always essential to pursue something less than the ideal. And that's the reason why national leaders, according to the analytical approach, must always distinguish between the essential interests of a nation, upon which hinge its security and welfare, and demands of secondary importance, which are always questions for negotiation and compromise. The primary task of leadership, then, consists in determining the hierarchy of the nation's interests, measured always against the traditional interests and the calculated strength of other powers. Diplomacy, according to this approach to foreign affairs, serves as the necessary, and except for war, the only means available for defending a nation's interests in its conflicts with other nations that also pursue interests of their own. But those who believe that the United States must and can do more than this have accepted a competing approach to foreign affairs, namely the ideological. This school of thought views external affairs largely in philosophical and psychological terms. Measured by this standard, foreign policies reflect not a nation's hierarchy of interests, but rather its prevailing political, social, and religious beliefs. Diplomacy thus becomes a function of a political system. It serves an idea, not a nation. It looks beyond nations to individuals, not to the multi-state system in which all nations are suspended, but to a world community and the people that compose it. Its accent is less on specific questions than on the common interests of mankind: peace, freedom, justice, self-government. This school of thought seeks not to understand and control the use of power with countering power, but to eliminate it from human affairs completely. It reflects, therefore, a deep faith in reason and in progress, and anticipates in every crisis the creation of a peaceful and stable world order based on liberty and justice, beyond the elimination of any enemy of the moment. Although such notions as these latter ones have been shared by few people in history, their origin and strength in America is not difficult to understand. They rest on the American concept of mission, a conviction that the United States is the most fortunate and blessed of nations in both its democratic institutions and its amazing productivity, simply carries a special responsibility to extend its beneficence to other less fortunate peoples of the globe. These ideas, at least superficially, find their rationale in the American Declaration of Independence. For this document assumes a sort of international rationality and abhors oppression and all irrational uses of power. It proclaims basic notions of American nationhood, such as freedom, justice, equality, and harmony of interest. Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense, which in 1776 so effectively rationalized the concept of independence, had no interest in the use of force. He simply assumed that once the American tie with England was broken, that the United States would enjoy universal friendship. Security would simply reside in detachment from the affairs of the world. According to him, power was not to be husbanded, not to be sought. Paine, idealist that he was concerned with the ends of policy. The means for establishing or maintaining those ends were simply not his concern. It is from the Declaration of Independence, then, with its high idealism, that has stemmed this American sense of mission. If all men are born free, if all men are equal under natural law, then why should not the United States, having engrafted such assumptions onto its national life, accept the obligation to do less than extend them to other nations? With time, this sense of mission would cause some Americans to identify the national interest of the United States with every revolution abroad. And yet, from the beginning, those who would, on the one hand, deny the efficacy of power in international affairs, and on the other hand, accept the obligation to reforge human society, have faced the thought embodied in the American Constitution. This document proclaims no universals. There's no language of world mission here. The Constitution was built on the concept of power, and so Alexander Hamilton viewed it in his famous Federalist Papers. For Hamilton, the United States existed in a world of conflict in which nations had no choice but to define and protect their interests by wielding what he termed the engines of coercion. What mattered to Hamilton were the means of policy. For only the power which a government wielded gave meaning to any of its objectives. Standing among the Earth's powers meant that the United States entered into relations with them on their terms. Hamilton, as Washington's famous Secretary of the Treasury, soon had occasion to reinforce his concepts of national interest. When France and England went to war in 1793, the nation divided immediately between those who favored a pro-French involvement on the side of France and those who preferred a pro-British policy of official neutrality. President Washington eventually decided in behalf of neutrality, but he immediately faced enormous opposition from the followers of Thomas Jefferson, who were devotees of France. And immediately Hamilton defended the administration of Washington with one of the most famous of all of his documents and one of the outstanding statements ever made in the field of foreign affairs by any American leader, namely his Pacificus Papers, published in the spring of 1794. In this classic statement of the Pacificus Papers, Hamilton again states rather clearly what should be the basis of national policy. And he says, "The rule of morality is not precisely the same between nations as between individuals. The duty of making its own welfare the guide of its actions is much stronger upon the former than upon the latter, in proportion to the greater magnitude and importance of national compared with individual happiness, and to the greater permanency of the effects of national than of individual conduct. Existing millions, and for the most part future generations, are concerned in the present measures of a government, while the consequences of the private actions of an individual ordinarily terminate with himself or are circumscribed within a narrow compass. Whence it follows that an individual may on numerous occasions meritoriously indulge the emotions of generosity, not only without an eye to, but even at the expense of his own interest. But a government can rarely, if at all, be justifiable in pursuing a similar course. And if it does so, ought to confine itself within much stricter bounds." Now, Washington and Hamilton established the basic principles of American foreign policy during Washington's first administration. As Washington said in 1795, near the end of his second term, "In every act of my administration, I have sought the happiness of my fellow citizens. My system for the attainment of this object has uniformly been to overlook all personal, local, and partial considerations, to contemplate the United States as one great whole, and to consult only the substantial and permanent interests of our country." He warned the nation never to aspire to more than this, declaring that, and again I quote, "It is a maxim founded on the universal experience of mankind that no nation is to be trusted further than it is bound by its interest, and no prudent statesman or politician will venture to depart from it." Washington regarded as dangerous the intrusion of morality or ideology into foreign affairs. The Federalists under Washington committed the United States to a flexible, amoral worldview, which would maximize the country's freedom to pursue its own requirements. Washington never stated this better, indeed no one has, than he did it in his farewell address when he said, "The nation which indulges towards another an habitual hatred or an habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interests." Now, Washington's farewell address, despite its intrinsic brilliance, did not terminate the debate on the nature of American foreign policy. The sense of obligation was already too deeply established, and thus between the two poles of the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution, between the emphasis on ends and the emphasis upon means, the dialogue continued. But until the end of the 19th century, it was limited to theory and sentiment, not to policy. Even those American idealists who on occasion acknowledged the potential contribution which American civilization might make to human society thought less of involvement in revolutions abroad than in the creation of a society in America which might be worthy of emulation. For such noted leaders of America as Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, the United States was never more than an example setter for the rest of the world. In actuality, all basic American foreign policy in the 19th century was preoccupied with finite goals which would serve national interests. And when revolutions in Europe or in Latin America raised appeals at home and abroad that the United States pursued the cause of liberty, there were always conservative Americans who denied that the United States carried any special load of responsibility to the victims of oppression. Without exception, those prior to 1898 who were responsible for American foreign policy, who were in positions of power, pursued only the interests of the nation. It is even doubtful if the objectives of those that sought more had any relationship to their true motives, because no one who favored more than the pursuit of national interest in the 19th century ever conserved himself with the means indicated to achieve those objectives. And therefore it seems quite clear that all of them were much more concerned with popularity at home than with liberty abroad. For example, during the revolutions of 1848, American idealism burned with unusual brightness. In Congress, the noted Jacksonian leader, Lewis Cass of Michigan, claimed for the United States the obligation to underwrite the cause of liberty in Europe. On one occasion, he declared in Congress, and I quote, "While we disclaim any crusading spirit against the political institutions of other countries, we may well regard with deep interest the struggling efforts of the oppressed throughout the world and deplore their defeat and rejoice in their success. And can anyone doubt that the evidences of sympathy which are borne to Europe from this great republic will cheer the hearts even when they do not aid the purposes of the downtrodden masses to raise themselves, if not to power, at least to protection?" Cass, in other words, would involve the American people emotionally in the revolutions of Europe, but questions of policy always seemed to escape him. When the campaign of 1852 developed, a movement was organized called a Young America in order to avail themselves of whatever liberal sentiment existed in this country towards the faltering revolutions of Europe. On this occasion, Cass again, in 1852, told a New York audience, "I do not advocate going to war, but the time is coming when the voice of this nation will be potential throughout the world. I trust the time will soon come when not a hostile drum shall roll and not a hostile cannon be fired throughout the world if we say your cause is not a just and right one." European liberals eventually discovered, to their disillusionment, that Young America was always aimed more at the German vote of the Middle West than at the success of European revolution, because it was this movement's total unconcern for the formulation of policy which might achieve its purposes that exposed it to the ridicule of American conservatives. Now, without doubt, the real break in the history of American foreign policy comes in 1898, when President McKinley defended the annexation of the Philippine Islands in purely humanitarian terms. If Americans in previous decades had sought to affix American foreign policy to sentiment, it was McKinley, who was President of the United States, brought such notions for the first time to the center of the policy-making process. During a speaking tour of the Middle West in October 1898, to test the nation's support of an annexationist program aimed at the Philippine Islands, McKinley dwelt only on the theme of responsibility to the Filipinos. His remarks at Columbus, Ohio, I think were typical. He said, "We know what our country is now in its territory, but we do not know what it may be in the near future. But whatever it is, whatever obligation shall justly come from this humanity, we must take up and perform and as free, strong, brave people accept the trust which civilization puts upon us." The president, in these speeches which he made in this tour across the country, simply refused to dwell on the burdens of empire. His final decision to annex the Philippine Islands, he rationalized, like the Spanish-American War itself, with appeals to humanity. As he said to a group of visiting clergymen at the White House, there was nothing left to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and to uplift and civilize and Christianize them, and by God's grace do the best we could for them as our fellow men for whom Christ also died. In destroying thus the nation's historic political isolation from the Eastern Hemisphere, all in the name of humanitarianism, McKinley divorced the basic foreign policies of the United States from their established course. The country deserted in the process of acquiring the Philippine Islands those principles of statecraft which had guided every administration from George Washington to Grover Cleveland. And it was simply the splendid victory of the American Navy at Manila that obscured the magnitude of this departure in the field of foreign affairs. Yet the American commitment to the status quo in the Western Pacific had hardly begun. At the turn of the century, the McKinley administration announced the famous open door policy for China, establishing in the process an American interest in the economic and territorial integrity of a vast, amorphous nation located in a region of Asia where other nations, especially Japan and Russia, possessed not only greater power, but also far greater interest than did the United States. Again, this vast obligation was undertaken thoughtlessly, always in the name of humanitarianism, reflecting this kind of sense towards the Chinese people, a sense of obligation from which the American people have never been able to escape. Now, this trend towards overcommitment in the Far East met the determined opposition of realists who recognized the immensity of the rejection here of an established foreign policy. Such leaders as the industrialist Andrew Carnegie reminded his readers in the North American Review in 1898 and 1899 that the United States did not possess the naval power in the Western Pacific capable of defending the status quo in the Far East. Nor, he said, does this country have any intention of building that kind of naval power. Better, he said, to give up these islands than to hold them as a source of tension and war. Early in his second term as President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt expressed again this fundamental criticism of the new direction which American foreign policies were taking. In a letter to the noted British historian George Trevelyan, Theodore Roosevelt wrote, "I wonder if you will agree with me when I say that it seems to me that the England of Palmerston and of Russell, like the United States today, is too apt to indulge in representations on behalf of weak peoples which do them no good, but and irritate the strong and tyrannical peoples to whom the protest is made. It seems to me that the protest on behalf of the Poles to Russia in 1863 and the protest on behalf of the Danes to Germany about the same time were harmful rather than beneficial." Says Roosevelt, "Out in the West, we used to consider it a cardinal crime to draw a revolver and brandish it unless we meant to shoot. And it is apt to turn out sheer cruelty to encourage men by words and then not back them up by deeds." Ignoring the entire intellectual tradition of the Founding Fathers, Woodrow Wilson, following the outbreak of war in July 1914, identified America's role in world affairs with the creation of a rational, peaceful international system. At the core of Wilson's thought was the conviction that the nation's political, social, and moral uniqueness had assigned it a transcendent mission to serve humanity. "America was born," said Wilson, "that men may be free." His exhortation to the nation on Independence Day, 1914, was characteristic when he said, "America has lifted high the light which will shine into all generations and guide the feet of mankind to the goal of justice and liberty and peace." And as the struggle after 1914 moved from trench to trench along the Western Front, and the contestants became locked in a process of futile destruction, Wilson informed the American people that Europe beckoned, not for American aid, but for American leadership in building a better world. And he said, "Why is it that all nations turn to us with the instinctive feeling that if anything touches humanity, it touches us?" And then he answered his own question, saying, "Because it knows that ever since we were born as a nation, we have undertaken to be the champions of humanity and the rights of man." Even in war, he said, the United States would struggle only for the rights of mankind. Addressing a Chicago audience in January 1916, Mr. Wilson said again, "America has no reason for being unless her destiny and her duty be ideal. It is their incumbent privilege to declare and stand for the rights of men. Nothing less is worth fighting for. And eventually, Wilson, in an effort to establish the intellectual bases of a new world order, warred on every vestige of the established international system. For him, the special villains in the peace that always kept the world at war were secret diplomacy, the balance of power, and the concept of national interest. His continued search for alternatives to these accoutrements of power politics, upon which to build the foundations of world peace, culminated in his message to the Senate on January 22, 1917. Future peace, Wilson declared in this speech, must be secured not by warring nations alone, but by the organized force of mankind. And then, having assigned to the silent masses of the world the power and the right to control world affairs, he committed the United States to the support of a new post-war organization which would carry out the universal interest of mankind in pursuing the peace. It was essential, therefore, that the European war be fought, he said, to achieve a just and secure peace, not a new balance of power. He said there must be not a balance of power, but a community of power, not organized rivalries, but an organized common peace. Wilson's great crusade for humanity continued to mount after the American entry into World War I and reached its ultimate grandeur in a speech which he made at San Diego, California, in September 1919 during his famous Western tour in behalf of the League of Nations. And this quotation from Wilson is probably the all-time high point of committing the American people to the cause of humanity. In this speech, Mr. Wilson said in part, "We went into this war not only to see that autocratic power of that sort never threatened the world again, but we went into it for an even larger purpose than that. The autocratic powers may spring up, but there is only one soil in which they can spring up, and that is the wrongs done to free peoples of the world. The heart and center of this Treaty of Versailles is that it sets at liberty people all over Europe and in Asia who had hitherto been enslaved by powers which were not their rightful sovereigns and masters. So long as wrongs like that exist in the world, you cannot bring permanent peace to the world. I go further than that. So long as wrongs of that sort exist, you ought not to bring permanent peace to the world, because those wrongs ought to be righted, and enslaved peoples ought to be free to right them. For my part, I will not take any part in composing difficulties that ought not to be composed, and a difficulty between an enslaved people and its autocratic rulers ought not to be composed. We in America have stood from the day of our birth for the emancipation of peoples throughout the world who were living unwillingly under governments which were not of their own choice." Now, you can well imagine the emotional appeal of Wilson's words, stating that American foreign policy dare not rest until all men are free. But of course, he's pursuing an abstraction here, and he does not have the power to achieve it. Now, since Wilson's day, the world has witnessed a variety of revolutions which have had profound bearing upon international relationships. For example, the Soviet Union and mainland China have evolved into significant power centers and have vastly altered the traditional European-dominated balance of power. The emergence of new weapons has intensified the tendencies towards bipolarism in world politics by concentrating destructiveness in the hands of two nations, the United States and the USSR. The revolutionary upheaval of Asia and Africa has brought dozens of new states into being and thereby decreased the prestige, if not the power, of the old imperial nations of Europe. Lastly, the revolution in communications renders every world problem a matter of instantaneous concern everywhere and goads governments into statements and decisions ahead of their ability to comprehend. These changes have narrowed the margin for error, have increased the price of thoughtlessness, and have decreased the capacity of the once great powers to manage the world. Now, these vast changes to the nation's will, which should dictate caution in assaying one's external objectives, have actually intensified in recent years the dialogue concerning this nation's proper role in world affairs. No longer, moreover, is that dialogue academic. Since the days of Wilson, it has been related to hard choices and to real events. National goals defined in terms of world mission and the deep-seated expectation of unity and harmony as the genuine norms in international life still arouse the expectation of Americans in the face of obdurate realities. Never before, it appears, has the national outlook been so thoroughly conditioned by the themes of the Declaration of Independence. Never has the American sense of mission been so limitless. In recent years, all American actions have been justified in terms of universal principles of justice and freedom. Again, the reason for this response to conditions abroad is clear enough. The enemy is communism. And because communism looms as the special antagonist and danger to values which lie deep in the American heritage, the war on it partakes of two objectives. The first is security against the enormous physical power of the communist nations. The second is the freedom of those who live under the communist system, under the assumption that the system is so evil that no one living under it, except perhaps its rulers, can be anything less than oppressed. The first objective dictated and has sustained the fundamental American policy of containment. The second, especially under the guidance of John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State in the 1950s, encouraged a policy of liberation, the bringing of freedom to the millions of people that exist behind the iron and the bamboo curtains. Indeed, much of the anti-communism in American policy since 1945 finds its clearest expression in the Atlantic Charter, with its four freedoms, all of them universal. This new sense of obligation, emanating from the nation's fear of communism and communist power, a danger, of course, which now looms on the left, has had the effect of transforming completely the traditional role of liberals and conservatives in their adherence to ideological and universal objectives in American foreign policy. Remember that Cass and all of his followers of the 19th century are on the liberal side. Those that pursue the goal of obligation of humanity are the liberals. But today, you see, it's completely reversed, because the enemy today is not on the right as it used to be when it was monarchy, aristocracy, and even as late as Hitler, it was always on the right. Now it's on the left, and the result is you have a complete changeover. And of course, nothing bears this out better than the statement on foreign affairs in the Republican platform of 1964. And note the similarity between this statement of the Republican Party of 1964 and the statement of Woodrow Wilson of 1919. And there you see the complete reversal of roles in the attitudes towards American foreign policy today. Well, I quote from this platform in brief: "The stand must be victory for freedom. There can be no peace, there can be no security until this goal is won. As long as communist leaders remain ideologically fixed upon ruling the world, there can be no lesser goal. This is the supreme test of America's foreign policy. It must not be defaulted. In the balance is human liberty, every place on earth. Republicans reaffirm their long-standing commitment to a course leading to eventual liberation of the communist-dominated nations of Eastern Europe, Asia, and Latin America, including the peoples of Hungary, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Albania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Armenia, Ukraine, Yugoslavia, and its Serbian, Croatian, and Slovene peoples, Cuba, mainland China, and many others." Now, on the question of the means to achieve the liberty of all of these peoples, the Republican platform had no more to say than did Woodrow Wilson. Now, the dual purpose of American Cold War policy aimed on the one hand towards the limited goal of security and on the other at the universal goal of freedom and justice has created a rather serious dichotomy in the official between the official rhetoric and the day-to-day actions of government. At the level of our actual decisions, the United States has sought and achieved, at least in Europe, a rather remarkable stabilization of the lines of demarcation which separate the Western from the Soviet world. At the level of rhetoric, however, the United States pursues a variety of objectives which conform generally to the principle of self-determination of peoples. And it's because Americans cannot agree on the proper objects of policy in the struggle against Russia and China particularly, that the national leadership at any point of conflict dare never make it clear whether it's contending for the specific interest or for the universal ideal. As a matter of fact, both are always tied up in the same speeches. But this is the reason why. Simply because Americans do not agree on what our goal in this world should be. Upon examination, it appears clear that the concepts of Woodrow Wilson, with their basic assumption that change to be legitimate must also be peaceful, and the post-war objectives of liberation are directed at one common goal. Whatever the universals proclaimed by American leaders, the actual policies of the United States in the 20th century have always sought to maintain as much as possible the status quo that existed at the turn of the century, when the United States enjoyed almost absolute security at almost no cost. Note every basic policy in the last two generations. It's well to recall that Woodrow Wilson applied the doctrine of self-determination of peoples only to the defeated powers, not the victors of World War I. The British, the French, the Belgian, the Dutch, and the American empires were untouched, even as he proclaimed the doctrine of self-determination and its universal triumph. The point is, it was applied to what? The enemies of the moment. Those that were standing in the way of the creation of that good world of 1900. Who? Germany, Austria-Hungary, Turkey, the defeated nations. Those that were getting out of hand, those that were threatening the established balance of power. And similarly, few Americans of the era of the Cold War have sought to apply the doctrines of self-determination with their emphasis upon freedom and justice at the weakness of human society which exists everywhere, but rather at the specific repression which exists behind the iron and the bamboo curtains. Again, the national sense of obligation, when applied to external affairs, has been directed less at the creation of a worldwide utopia than at the undoing of those powers which seem to stand in the way of the recreation of the world as it existed in 1900. And today those nations are China and Russia. What then, I ask, is the United States obligated to do by its history, its traditions, its interests? This cannot be answered without reference to a second question. What is the United States capable of doing? On one point, the record is clear. It cannot do everything. It cannot create a world of universal freedom and justice. For such a world, it seems to me, is beyond human attainment. Its inaccessibility lies in human nature itself. Perhaps no American recognized the limits of national action more dramatically than did the conservative Yale sociologist William Graham Sumner when in 1899 he wrote in opposition to the acquisition of the Philippine Islands, "There are some things that Americans cannot do. Americans cannot make 2 and 2 equal 5. You may answer that this is an arithmetic impossibility and it is not in the range of our subject. Very well. Americans cannot collect $2 a gallon tax on whiskey. They tried it for many years and they have failed. This is an economic and political impossibility, the roots of which are in human nature. So far as yet appears, Americans cannot govern a city of 100,000 inhabitants so as to get comfort and convenience at the low cost and without jobbery. The fire department of this city," and of course he's referring to a city of New Haven, Connecticut, where Yale University is located, "the fire department of this city is now demoralized by political jobbery. And Spain and all her possessions are not worth as much to you and to me as the efficiency of the fire department of New Haven." The Americans in Connecticut cannot abolish the rotten borough system. This is a political impossibility. Americans cannot assure suffrage to Negroes throughout the United States. They have tried it for 30 years, and now, contemporaneously with their war with Spain, it has finally demonstrated that it is a failure. Worse still, Americans cannot assure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to Negroes inside the United States. The laws of nature and of human nature are just as valid for Americans as for anyone else. And if we commit acts, we shall have to take consequences just like other people. Therefore, prudence demands that we look ahead to see what we are about to do and that we gauge the means at our disposal. And if we do not want to bring calamity on ourselves and on our children, which is the reason why he warned against the commitments in the Pacific at the turn of the century, as a drastic overcommitment of the United States, which in the long run would cost the nation dearly. Now, those who would cite Lincoln's words to warn Americans that the world cannot exist half slave and half free, that it must be all one or all the other, I simply remind you that it's always been so. In fact, such an approach to world affairs reveals a total lack of appreciation for the vast complexities in human society. It's not clear, indeed, that the world is half slave and half free. That portion of it which Americans choose to call free, I remind you, is no political, economic, and social utopia. There are enough problems in this country to tax our ingenuity for a century. Many governments allied to the United States are little but military dictatorships. Not all infringements on human dignity and human freedom are behind the iron and bamboo curtains. And that portion of the world which we choose to call unfree certainly is not a region of general attractiveness. I'm sure none of us would want to live there. But remember that the deep human dilemmas which the governments of that part of the world have faced are not simply the products of tyranny. Those problems have existed in one form or another for centuries. They lie deep in political traditions, in unyielding physical environments. The power of the United States to create a utopia on either side of the iron and bamboo curtains is vastly limited, and this fact eliminates, at least for me, the nation's obligation to humanity. The nation is not obligated to do what it cannot do. Whatever its power or ambition, no nation has really ever succeeded in serving more than its own interests. And it seems to me in this context, Washington's farewell address still remains today as the finest statement to guide the foreign affairs of any nation which exists in modern literature. The major unanswered challenges to America today are, of course, in the gray areas of Africa and Asia, where stability is indeed an elusive commodity. But if the West cannot have its way in the face of nationalism, let's remember that the Soviet bloc cannot either. The great revolutions of Asia and Africa are indigenous, and they're fundamentally without ideology. And I think it might be well to begin with the assumption that Asia and Africa are going to manage their own affairs in the long run. And I think anyone that tends to stand in their way will soon discover that one has overcommitted oneself in terms of achievement. What forces the United States into a persistent pattern of defying this kind of political judgment is, of course, its self-imposed obligation in Asia particularly, to stop the expansion of communist power. The tendency to see Moscow or Beijing in every uprising has the dual effect of, on the one hand, committing the United States to the status quo where it is difficult to maintain, and on the other hand, that of isolating the United States and its policies from most of its best friends. All nations allied to the United States agree in the abstract that communist aggression must be prevented. They simply cannot agree on its nature or on the time and place where aggression ought to be stopped. All countries of the world, in fact, are dedicated to the prevention of communist aggression. All of our allies, all the neutrals, and even all of the communist countries. And none of them more so than the Soviet Union itself. In fact, if there's any nation in the world today that fears communist aggression, it's the Soviet Union. And believe me, it has a right to, with that 3,000-mile common border with China. How would we like to have that? And the Russians are worried about it with good reason, because Russia and China have been basically enemies throughout modern history. Well, fulfilling one's obligation to humanity in a region of economic backwardness and political turmoil is difficult indeed. The United States certainly has not satisfied those nations who have ambitions which go beyond the status quo. But let's remember that American policies basically have been limited status quo policies. And to that extent, they have the overwhelming support of the people of the world. The nation's continuing problem is not unlike that which faced the first administration of George Washington. It is the unresolved question of national obligation, the ubiquitous rhetoric of mission, because it is never attached to actual policies, misleads friends and enemies, and always tends to elevate the expectations of the American people beyond which America can achieve. It commits the country to what thus becomes embarrassing. And to a large extent, I think the problem is self-created. Having established the goals that are unachievable, critics of the nation's foreign policies are free to condemn the government for not achieving what they have insisted it ought to achieve, although they never come up with the means of achieving them. Yet this gap between what is held to be possible and what actually is possible creates a limitless field for partisanship. In part, I think it's the refusal of Washington officials to establish and maintain before the American people the concept of limited power and national interest that exposes the actions of government to endless review. Too often, leaders fail not only to acknowledge the fact that national action abroad must of necessity be limited to the nation's legitimate interests, but also to demonstrate that such behavior has comprised the essence of statesmanship throughout the ages. What has perpetuated the great debate of America's proper role in human betterment has persistently caused the country to ask too much of itself, and this in large measure, I think, has been because of the failure of government to play its necessary educational role in reminding the American people that this country, with all of its power, is still far from omnipotent. Now, there are many unrecognized arrangements in the world which defy the principle of self-determination. No American takes any pleasure in their existence. If the primary obligation of any people must be to themselves, the United States certainly means no harm to others. And if it possesses the wealth and the determination to engage in policies of foreign aid, to sustain the Alliance for Progress, to dispatch a Peace Corps to the four corners of the world, so much the better. Even to Hamilton, remember, national interest was not to be identified with selfishness. But foreign aid, despite its humanitarian objectives, must not be confused with any Wilsonian crusade for humanity, because foreign aid is a limited program well within the capabilities of the United States. Finally, the overriding American obligation, it seems to me, must be to world peace and to international stability. For only in that context can the interest of both the United States and the vast bulk of the world's population be satisfied. And to the extent that the nation's considerable physical power has contributed to that stability, the fundamental and the limited policies of the United States, if not, it seems to me, always the rhetoric of its leaders, have served the country well.
Thank you, Dr. Grebner, for your stimulating address. We hope to see many of you at 3:30 this afternoon at the Student Lounge. Convocation is adjourned.